This podcast is produced by Brave Voice Films. As a quick programming note, this episode was recorded a little over a year ago. We took a break from the regular schedule of this show to further develop the concept and to be able to produce the episodes more reliably. We will resume this normal schedule starting next week. For more information about Brave Voice Films, you can go to bravevoicefilms.com, where you can purchase a DVD, Blu-ray, or digital download of our latest feature-length documentary, Out of Sight.
Friends of Reference.
Three films, two cinephiles, one podcast.
Cinema is my secret passion.
It's a foreign movie, a film is what it is.
This film was a personal vision, not a marketing machine.
Yep, we only show first-run art films here.
But art films make people feel funny.
We're getting too many mainstream movies.
Episode 2.
The one where we talk about nature.
And we're back for a second episode.
Which is, honestly, it's a great start to have a second episode. It's actually quite stunning how easy it is to start a project and then immediately let it drop off.
Yeah, just ask network television.
Oh, hey.
I'm Kyle Mahaney. I'm a filmmaker and film editor.
I'm Matthew Bonanno. I am an engineer and filmmaker and film watcher and collector.
Yeah, you take the collector a little far.
I'm probably going to die when one of these stacks tips over on me and crushes me.
So this is Frames of Reference, the podcast where we talk about a new film coming out now that you might not have heard of and it might not have gotten the attention that it deserves. And then we try to link it thematically to other films that are important in film history.
So this week we're going to be talking about Middle America, both in terms of economic and geographical location.
And that's why we're talking about a film set in the Southeast.
Well, you know, it's in the middle of the vertical part of America, kinda. We're going to be looking at The Rider, directed by Chloe Zhao, which is about a rodeo cowboy in the Badlands of South Dakota. We're going to be looking at Badlands, directed by Terrence Malick, which is set across South Dakota and Montana. And then we're going to be looking at George Washington, which was David Gordon Green's 2000 directorial debut, set in North Carolina.
And heavily influenced by Badlands.
Heavily, yeah, very very much, you know, a Malick love letter from a budding director.
So let's start with The Rider. This is Chloe Zhao's second film, though you probably missed her first film. So Chloe Zhao's previous film came out a couple years ago, Songs My Brother Taught Me. And it deals with the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And it kind of deals with the struggles of these Lakota Sioux siblings, you know, dealing with the poverty and various different addiction issues that is common on the Indian reservation. It was very interesting seeing, you know, a Chinese national's representation of the state of indigenous peoples in America. It premiered very, very well at the 2015 Cannes Film Festival.
It is. It's kind of ridiculous, almost. This woman, born in Beijing, went to school in London, moved to Los Angeles, and now has made two very evocative films set in North Midwest.
Yeah, both in South Dakota.
Right. It's definitely an interesting geographical tack.
And she really brings a unique image to kind of the state of the Midwestern American experience.
Yeah, a very distinct vision of, I think, alienation that the sort of isolation of the land brings out in you.
And just like forgotten lands.
Right.
So this film, The Rider, is her second film. It premiered at the 2017 Cannes Film Festival. Unfortunately, I did not get to see it while I was there. But yeah, it took the Art Cinema Award at Cannes, and it got immediately snapped up by Sony Picture Classics, and they gave it a incredibly limited release in April this year.
Yeah, it got snapped up, and they haven't really done anything with it since.
I think it was New York and LA only, but it was real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And in the US, it's hitting DVD and streaming services on August 7th. There is no Blu-ray release, so if you want a really high-quality version, I'd say grab it on Amazon Video. And international people are up a creek, because there is no international distribution lined up for this.
It's really a shame, I mean, that Sony has kind of left it out to dry so much.
I mean, it's not Sony's fault. They only bought U.S. rights.
Oh, well, right, sure. But even for the U.S., like, I would love to have this in my collection. And on Blu-ray, I mean, it's such a pretty film.
Yeah, and I think we're kind of going to continue to see indie films just slowly die on physical media.
Well, my hope is that little places, or, you know, little indie studios and distributors like Drafthouse, like A24, can pick up some of the slack. I mean,
little indie distributors like A24.
Who's I say little indie, I mean like big indie, little AAA.
Yeah.
Is that a game? That's an only gaming term, or I don't know what they little blockbuster studios.
Mini majors.
Yeah, mini major. I mean, A24 has just had a string of great releases.
That's one thing. Before we get too off topic, I don't understand how people are like, yeah, A24 only puts out good movies.
Oh, they don't.
I'm like, have you seen some of their minor releases? Yeah. I watched How to Talk to Girls at Parties the other day. That film is terrible.
Yeah, they've got plenty of trash too, but it's all very distinct.
Yeah, they got a style going on. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I'm very much a fan of having like the fact if they have all these like high profile releases that are really good, and then they also got a lot of little not that great movies. I'm very much okay with that. I think it's a reality of releasing independent film, and I would rather see it somewhere than not at all.
Well, and like, it's good that people are taking the time to pick these films up and release them.
Right, exactly.
You know, I kind of would like to see how a film like The Rider would be handled by someone like Bleecker Street or A24, and instead of, you know, the independent label of one of the majors, where it's just kind of been forgotten.
Yeah, it's just gonna languish.
But this film has been very well received. It has a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 94% on Metacritic. Before we get into the plot too much, I think one of the most interesting things is its use not only of amateur actors, which is something we talked about when we were talking about Ratcatcher last week.
Right.
But the fact that they're playing essentially exaggerated versions of themselves.
Yeah. So the film was about Brady, who lives with his father and younger autistic sister, and was once upon a time a rodeo star, but fell literally off the horse and ended up with brain damage. And that's been kind of plaguing him ever since, and has been coloring his decision of what to even make of his life now.
Yeah.
It's a very free-form film in that it features characters that flit in and out of his life very naturalistically, and it illustrates sort of his pressing decision of what am I going to make of myself when I am surrounded by people who have either left doing what they loved, which was riding horses, or continue doing it and ultimately destroyed their bodies. To that point, he has a friend with severe brain damage. On the other side, his dad is kind of a languishing alcoholic who stopped riding and he never wants to be like him.
Yeah, and, you know, he didn't get the injury from riding horses. It was from bull riding, but...
Right.
I think one of the biggest things is he's someone at a crossroads because he's forced to reinvent himself and he's not quite sure how.
One of the really important visualizations of the film, and I think very illustrative of its central theme, is the isolation of the Badlands. Because it's such a barren, literal wasteland, these characters, and Brady in particular, are forced really onto the track of being a rodeo star. It's what he loves, partially because it's really only what he knows. He does have a natural talent for it, and we kind of see that with scenes of him breaking horses and just the true genuine love he has for the animals, but the reality is
it's killing him.
Yeah, it's killing him, and it's not like he really ever had a choice. The film doesn't explicitly talk a whole lot about the economic conditions that are underpinning that.
That's kind of my big issue with this film, and I really liked it. It's a very pretty film.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like there's a massive elephant in the room that we never really explicitly talk about. There's references to, oh, they're gonna lose their trailer or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it never explicitly talks about the economic conditions, and it never addresses the fact that, you know, they're living on a reservation.
Part of that, I think, is it's a very subdued narrative. It's very much told via environment.
And I get that. It just feels like an omission.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do agree. I certainly am never one to be grumpy that class issues get brought up in film. It's one of my favorite themes is classism in films.
And like, it's implied, but I just feel like it doesn't confront why all these people are kind of stuck in their own path without many options available to them.
I think it might even be somewhat intentional because I don't think, I mean, to bring it even back to the last episode, we were talking about Ratcatcher and sort of lack of broader understanding about one's class and situation. I don't know how much Brady knows about opportunities outside of South Dakota.
Yeah.
There's this one scene where he goes to the pawn shop to pawn off his saddle because he's realized that he needs to stop riding or else it will kill him. He just kind of almost gets a lesson from the pawn shop cashier or the pawn shop clerk. And the clerk talks about, yeah, you know, we see guys come in here and eventually you just kind of, you got to stop riding. And he's surrounded by all this other stuff that's been pawned off. But it's one of the, actually the most colorful and interpersonal scenes in the film, I feel like. It's one of the scenes in the film that feels most out of the location. Those scenes and the scenes in the general store where Brady's briefly working to try to make some money while he's recovering, because they illustrate that outside, the closest you can get to outside of this.
And it's normalizing.
Right.
I think one of the big things is also just that entire scene you mentioned at the pawn shop is reflective not only of reinventing himself and giving up riding, but also the revelation that he's not going to be his father because he has a choice. He can choose what he wants to do there.
Did we get an explanation exactly for...
I just kind of took it as he was washed up.
Yeah, his father is just, you know, kind of an alcoholic and a gambler, but we don't really know exactly what caused him to stop.
No, I mean, it's tough on your body. Quite frankly, Brady probably wouldn't have had that much of a career left.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, he's what, like 19, 20? You know, get another 5 years in there, your body's going to fall apart on you.
If not sooner, just with the traumatic brain injury, I mean, he barely has control over his muscles. In his right hand.
This film deals with neurodivergence a lot between the sister who's autistic and played by herself, which is really a fascinating portrayal.
Yeah, it was actually a heavily improvised role. They pretty much just, you know, let her live herself, which I think is a fascinating approach to it.
But you also have almost every one of his friends presents in a way that suggests that they're also neurodivergent. You know, you have to wonder
either
how many of these kids have had traumatic brain injuries or concussions or, you know, something from riding.
Right.
Or just lack of education. It really sets an interesting tone.
I think it does. I mean, it certainly illustrates almost a difficulty Brady has with communicating even with them. Certainly, it seems like he's relatively neurotypical as far as we can tell. I mean, he certainly sees...
I think he's definitely more lyrical than the rest of the people show.
Right. I mean, he loves his sister very dearly, so he is closely...
He has a vision.
Yeah. He is able to comprehend the reality a little bit more than I think other people are of the trauma that this is even causing on themselves and options outside of them.
He still makes the choices to go and ride when he shouldn't. He still, you know, is choosing based on his gut rather than actual informed advice.
I mean, he still breaks horses, which is itself
incredibly dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous because, yeah, I mean... It's what he knows and what he loves. I mean, his father Wayne says several times, you know, that he is as stubborn as his late mother. Mm-hmm. I think the lack of his, you know, the loss of his mother is a pretty central vacuum in the story. I think it highlights some of the difficulties that come from a single parent household.
The family dynamic in general is very interesting.
Yeah, it's I don't want to say it's all stretched thin, but I think that's really what it is.
And a lot of people are acting outside of their comfort zone.
Right. Wayne doesn't really bring in a lot of money to like support the family to the point where he actually, you know, sells Brady's horse to be able to afford to pay, you know, pay to live in their trailer.
And he's a compulsive gambler, which that kind of explains destructive habits.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, he's trying to support Lily.
Right. He does. Yeah. He, you know,
he's trying to help her, you know, transition into adulthood, which how productive that is questionable, but
I mean, how productive it even could be. There's a degree to which
she's resistant because I think she's happy.
Yeah.
And I think she's the only character who's actually happy.
I would say she's the only character who doesn't seem to want something out of her reach.
Yep.
And I mean, many of my favorite scenes involved her and her sort of just complete comfort.
Yeah.
And it was always nice to see
that contrast.
Yeah, Brady kind of having to struggle with how to protect her, knowing that she you know, is really going to go her own way no matter what.
And I think the visual language of this film is really its strongest asset. Like, you know, this is territory we've tread many times in film. You know, you have films like Nebraska from a couple years ago. You have films like, obviously, we're going to talk about Terrence Malick's Badlands. Mm-hmm. But just the vast expanse that this film sets.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's shot in scope, and it's just huge. Like, you get the feeling of how isolated and cut off they are at every moment. And I think that's really the visual language. You know, this is not... This is a fairly languid film. It's not an easy watch as far as accessibility. But I think everyone will get something out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to be in sheer awe of how, I mean, not empty it is, but just how expansive it is, like you said. It's such a wonder to see that nature and man's insignificance and sheer tininess against it.
It's just a wasteland.
I mean, much like Malick, like you said, we're going to get into that with Badlands, it tells a very lyrical story of the geographical reality that forces the characters into the situation that they are in.
And not only that, but, you know, also like Malick, you know, it's about misfits. It's about misfits who don't quite have a meaning for their life. You know, Brady thought he had it, and then it's taken away from him. And it's trying to reposition yourself and find that meaning, which I think that's a core struggle for almost everyone.
It's a little bit of a subversion of the American dream.
Oh, totally.
Where, I mean, I say a little bit only because they're not really concerned about getting rich as much as it is defining yourself through your occupation and through your, this sort of American-centric lens of, I am what I do. And realizing that what I do is highly destructive to my body, and if I want to be what I do, I'm not going to be much longer.
Yeah.
We see that a lot with Lane, who suffered severe brain damage from a similar accident to Brady, and we see a lot of that mirror. That's Brady is looking into his friend, and he sees so much of himself, but he also sees his continued ability to speak with them through sign language. I mean, he lost so much brain function that he can't even speak.
But he's still there.
Right, he's still there, and he still has that human connection that he had with Lane. And I think that's a big part of the struggle is pulling out that part of their relationship and knowing that the central parts of their souls and their being are still there, despite that horrible, you know, destruction that's been done to the body.
Yeah, so that's The Rider. It's really good.
Yeah, I mean, I quite enjoyed it. I do want to check out Chloe Zhao's first film now, although it was a little bit less well-received, but I still...
This is an incredible new auteur director that everyone should be checking out. Yeah. I'm sure it's going to be on awards list at the end of the year. Probably not the big ones. This was nominated for 4 Independent Spirit Awards last year, and it didn't win anything, but, you know, it was nominated for Best Feature, Best Director, Best Editing, and Best Cinematography. So it had good play with the awards. I don't know which awards it's eligible for this year because, like I said, it premiered at Cannes last year, but had an American theatrical release this year. So we'll see if the Academy looks at it.
Yeah, I mean, I just hope more people can see it. Like we said, because it's such a limited release, you're going to have to watch it on VOD if you want to see it, it looks like.
Yeah, which that's a real shame because this film looks gorgeous in scope and should be projected.
So Badlands was Terrence Malick's debut. It premiered in 1973 at the New York Film Festival as the closing film. In the U.S., you can get it on Criterion Blu-ray. You can also see it on iTunes or Filmstruck. In the U.K., it has a Blu-ray release from Warner Brothers, and it's also on iTunes. It was regarded as one of the defining films of its decade. It has a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 76% on Metacritic.
And this is kind of interesting because it's in 73. So it's like the heart of the new Hollywood movement, but this feels so different from just about every other new Hollywood film.
It's remarkably prescient. Despite being a film released in the 70s, it still feels very aware of the violence that's inherent to American philosophy and American nationalism. It has a lot of the same isolation that The Rider has. I mean, it's set titularly in the Badlands. And I think a big part of what identifies its violence and its enabling of that violence is the expanse of the area in which it takes place.
And I think one of the important things is when you look at the new Hollywood movement, which is, you know, this uprising of, like, the first film school generation of directors in the late 60s and early 70s and even into the 80s, you know, you see a dramatic change right around 1973 in the tone. And obviously, you can't disassociate that from Vietnam. But you go from films like Tulane Blacktop and The Last Picture Show and The French Connection and even stuff like American Graffiti. And then you go, in 1973, you have Badlands and Mean Streets and Serpico and The Exorcist.
74, you have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I think very similarly...
And Chinatown.
...peels apart that the dirty underlayer of American culture and society.
And, you know, it really... You kind of look at that, this is like a defining film in changing how Americans viewed America. Which obviously would continue, you know, you have... The next year you have Mel Brooks with Blazing Saddles, which is a very pointy critique of our... kind of image. But, you know, you also have stuff like In the Midst of Watergate, All the President's Men coming out. And then you have, you know, films like Taxi Driver, which are just these brutally dark looks at the reality of what America's cities are like. And this is kind of the opposite of that. This is, as much as the grime and grit of Taxi Driver shows the underbelly of Manhattan, this is, again, showing the forgotten people in the Midwest. And it's showing the danger of how sparse things are.
So it's a semi-fictionalization of a murder spree committed by Charles Starkweather and an underage girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate. That was in 1958. The film starts with Martin Sheen playing Kit, where he meets 15-year-old Holly, played by Sissy Spacek, in this small town in South Dakota. She's a young teenage girl living with her father, and he is a garbage collector who quickly loses his job, and they fall into a very toxic romance, not the least of which is defined by the 10-year age difference between the 25-year-old Kit and 15-year-old Holly. They elope, and by elope we mean he kills her father and runs away with her. And the following crime spree that they go on, and murder spree, definitely peels apart some of the American dream and the geography that enables it.
And, you know, I'm not sure if it's even the age difference that's the biggest factor in what's off about their relationship.
Yeah, definitely Kit is dealing with some violent and antisocial characteristics.
I also think he's just a psychopath. He plays her really well, and she is infatuated with him. You know, it constantly brings up that he resembles James Dean.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is kind of a critique of that whole, you know, greaser generation of the violence that was associated in the portrayals of the greaser generation. And it's a look at what that actually was.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you brought up Blazing Saddles because, I mean, much like Rebel Without a Cause, you know, Blazing Saddles kind of took apart some of the racial tensions in Hollywood that, we still deal with to this day. And likewise, I mean, James Dean represents this kind of, I mean, rebel, but James Dean represents this kind of Hollywood ideal of the bad boy.
Also, just an image of masculinity that can get away with anything.
Right. So they basically, they travel along the Midwest, and they very rarely come across people. I mean, for a little while, they hide in, like, this woodlands until bounty hunters catch up with them. They continue traveling, and basically every time they meet someone in this, in a very isolated space, Kit ends up killing that person.
Yeah.
And then they continue running.
Except he doesn't kill... They come across a rich family, and they rob them. And they take his Cadillac and everything, and they take a bunch of supplies, but they don't kill him.
That's true. That is the one family they...
And that kind of sticks out.
I think it is important to note that Malick actually removed some of the most horrific crimes that...
Oh, in real life, he killed that family.
Yeah, he killed that family. I think he also...
He killed Holly, which is obviously the names have been changed. He killed her baby sister. Like an infant.
He killed a pet dog. He killed family friends. I think, I don't know if it's necessarily to the film's credit that it cut out some of those most horrific moment because I wonder if that would have done a better picture or would have painted a better picture of...
This is not a direct adaptation. It's inspired by.
Yeah.
You know, that would be like...
That's true.
You know, this is telling its own story.
I just wonder if that would have actually even better painted sort of the unhealthy power dynamic behind some of the infatuation that Holly might have had for Kit.
Mm-hmm. And I think Holly really represents how attracted to, like, this violent rebel archetype Americans were. Mm-hmm. And then once she sees the darkness of that, she gets scared.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that she even goes along with for it as long as she does, because at a certain point in the film, she says, like, I'd never seen Kit this violent before. I'm like, well, you know, he shot your dad in the stomach. That was, like, one of the first things y'all did together.
Yeah. Or
not even together. I mean, that's one of the first things that he did in your presence. Definitely, I mean, certainly I don't blame her necessarily for...
Which I really think that's... You know, this is what, like, 2 years after the Pentagon Papers come out. You know, I really think this is a film about Vietnam and kind of Americans coming to terms with the American experience in Vietnam.
Yeah, it's kind of implied that he might have military experience. Certainly the way he acts in the initial...
And I'm not even talking that directly, though. Like, yeah, it definitely implies that, you know, he was probably served in Korea or something.
Right, but...
But I'm talking just, like, more generally... America has worshipped throughout the 40s and 50s and all these Westerns, these very violent archetypes.
Yeah, I mean, the initial time that they're in that woodland area, he and she are living like this almost Swiss Family Robinson esque life where they have a treehouse and he runs around doing like military exercises where they pretend to, like, you know, what would we do if we were caught by people? And he sets up forest traps and he runs around with a gun, you know, much like a soldier in a movie would. And I think that's kind of where that infatuation is most immediately visible before any of the real horror sets in for Holly.
Yeah.
Is that sensation that we're just two kids out in the woods playing soldiers.
It's interesting you say two kids, because I think that's also, like, he's obviously incredibly manipulative, mm-hmm. but one of the reasons I say I don't think the age difference bothered me that much is he's very clearly someone who is a misfit and isn't mature enough to handle life. Now, he turns to this brutal violence, but I think that's an interesting dynamic that they're both misfits seeking kind of their role and their meaning, and he just gives up.
Certainly he has a degree of arrested development where he behaves, I mean, not unlike the teenage hooligans in Ratcatcher, mm-hmm. With that same kind of aimless violence. But I do think part of Holly's attraction to him is the fact that, I mean, at least physically, if not, you know, developmentally, he's older than she is, and so he has that kind of masculine authority that she would be attracted to.
And look at her father, you know.
There's not... Her father's a painter, on the other hand.
Yeah, and it's not only that, like, he's clearly not a very good parental figure.
Right.
Like, he shoots her dog for, what, like, disobeying him?
Yeah, because she's talking with Kit after he tells her not to.
Yeah, he straight up shoots her dog, which, you know, that burns him to her.
Right. Well, and I think it's interesting, I mean, that violence is his response, too. I mean, even as a painter, his way of parenting is, rather than actually providing any kind of logical parental advice or comfort or alternative, you know, don't do this thing. If you do this thing, I will violently respond by removing other things that you love.
And it's also just, it's kind of like this statement about how unfair life is, because the dog suffers.
Right.
Because of someone else's choices. And that's kind of a theme that's throughout this film. You know, someone else's choices causing suffering.
This sort of movie, in other directors' hands, you could easily see the gore and the violence getting the front billing.
Oh, and that's one thing that's interesting, is this never goes there. This is not a graphic movie.
The violence is very, very matter of fact, and, you know, comes and goes. Not a few of the killings even happen just off screen.
Yeah, it's very classical Hollywood in that respect.
I think very intentionally too. It doesn't want to make the violence
glorified
the reason you see the movie. Yeah. Not that I think the aestheticization of violence is inherently bad, but it very purposefully avoids giving viewers that excuse.
And I think one interesting thing is, while we're talking about, you know, these classical Hollywood symbols, it very much portrays Kit in the way that you would expect a hero to be portrayed. Mm-hmm. Because we have to remember that we are looking at this through Holly's eyes. So, you know, how things are set up in the beginning of the film, he is your classic Hollywood leading man. And then everything flips on its head.
I mean, Holly being the narrator of the film, it is flipped on its head, but within the universe, within the film's, you know, universe, it's not. I mean, towards the end, once Kit and Holly are inevitably caught, and in fact, actually, Holly finally is able to tell Kit that she doesn't want to keep going with him, and she, I don't know if she turns herself in. Yeah, she turns herself in, and Kit continues on his way, but it's not long after he's caught. But once they are caught, Kit is treated like a little bit of a
hero.
A local celebrity, yeah. Almost, yeah.
And I think one of the interesting things in the film at the end, since we got there, is, you know, he kind of revises his own narrative. And because Holly says in her voiceover, and we'll talk about the voiceovers for a little bit, you know, oh, he said he got a flat tire. But then at the same time, we're seeing him get out of the car and shoot his tire.
Right.
So I think there's a certain point that either he gave up or he chose to get caught.
Well, I think, and that's why I tend to lean more towards the horrible, manipulative, over, doesn't know what he's doing kind of narrative, is the fact that I think he is aware at this point. Like, he sees himself in the newspaper. He likes to read about himself in the newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
It makes a point of saying he's aware that he's got that celebrity status. It's actually almost, prophetic of the discussion we've had to have over the countless mass shootings, where now in the media we have to decide how much do we want to show of a perpetrator's face. Are we giving them, you know, a post-mortem glorification that they're kind of seeking? This is very much around that time where we're coming to the realization that the way that we portray people in the media has a sort of self-feeding effect.
Also, one thing that's very prescient is the kind of very early critique of the relationship between America and their firearms. You know, even after he's caught and he's this mass murderer, he's chatting it up with these marshals about what kind of weapon they're carrying. And,
right.
You know, it's very, there's a camaraderie there. And I think that's an interesting pointed critique from Malick.
He's throwing them like his lighter or a comb, knowing that it'll be an expensive souvenir that they can show off. There's certainly a feeling that it's really just about the direction the gun was pointing is all that really differs between these men and Kit. You know, Americans would view police officers as heroes, but at the same time, there's this sensation that it's just a question of which way the gun was pointing.
And that's one of the most interesting things, because in the film, they absolutely do act as heroes, but we're also rooting for the anti-hero because we see where they've come.
Right, and we have this moment of interaction between the hero and the anti-hero.
Incredibly violent. It's this cyclical violence.
Very gross that it's all taken at such a face value. And yet we also know it's kind of inherent to how we view our media and our Westerns and our American culture and history.
I think one thing that just, I can't emphasize enough, you know, Malick is known for this incredibly lyrical content. And his narratives are always really interesting. The voiceover in this film is very unique because it forces a first person, which is something very difficult to manage in film, through the lens of Holly's experience. But it also establishes the wilderness that they're surrounded by as its own character.
Right. Well, I think very similarly to the writer, like the expansiveness and the desolation of the geography is its own actor in the game.
Yes.
And its own force, I mean, literal force of nature, I suppose, that is dictating some of the conditions and the behaviors of these people. A big part of why I think they were able to stay on the run for so long is the fact that there's nobody out here.
But it turns against them. You know, right. So many of the key plot points are, we're running out of gas.
Right. You know, honestly, we're kind of amazing that they get as far as they do.
The Expanse is as much an enemy of theirs as it is their friend. And it turns on them in the end. Right. Because they can't outrun him.
Which is itself a very apt and beautiful, I think, metaphor for the reality of violence for America. You know, how much of this is in our DNA? How long can we keep using it and running with it and from it before it eventually turns on us? I mean, I would argue that there was never a point where it wasn't turning on us already, but it seems like those chickens are certainly coming to roost now more than ever.
Yeah, and speaking of, you know, how long can you run from our innate violence? George Washington by David Gordon Green, notable director of such art house classics as Pineapple Express.
And the upcoming Halloween movie, which I'm very excited for.
I'm definitely excited for that. This is a very different film for David Gordon Green, if you're familiar with the rest of his work.
Yeah.
It premiered in February of 2000 at the Berlin Film Fest. And then in North America, it premiered at TIFF the same year, where it won the Discovery Award. And it also made a big splash at Newport with a Best Actor Award awarded to the entire ensemble, a Best Director Award, and Best Dramatic Film. So it was a big film on the festival circuit when it came out. And it came out right during this renaissance of new American independent cinema.
Yeah, it definitely learns a lot from, I mean, certainly on one hand, it's a little bit of a love letter to Malick.
Oh, totally.
It also learns a lot, I think, from new American cinema and American independent cinema, and kind of the grittiness and the DIY attitude of making these films and just letting actors and environments speak for themselves.
It's really interesting, some of the choices as far as like framing of shots and zooms, even though they shot, you know, on legitimate cinema cameras, it's very reminiscent of what was happening on video cameras from the Dogma 95 movement in the mid-90s with directors like Lars von Trier. So you definitely have that influence from, you know, these new American cinema directors who are really rewriting the rules of cinema in a way that hadn't really happened since the French New Wave.
So Dogma 95 is like an experimental filmmaking movement that Danish directors Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg developed. It's kind of a manifesto / collective of filmmaking ideals.
It's an experiment. Yeah, it's very strict rules that were very inventive for the time, mostly because of the immediate prevalence of quality personal video recorders.
Right. I mean, von Trier himself really only made a couple of films that actually adhered to the standards. It's more of a goal of trying to make films as naturalistic as possible. So it's ideas like shooting has to be done on location rather than on a set. Camera has to be handheld. The director can't be credited. These ideas of making the film sort of refusing to adhere to any ideals of special effects, post-production, or other gimmicks that would reduce the film's quote-unquote purity. On the other hand, then you have American independent cinema, which is relatively modern, so like mid-90s movies that were becoming more provocative.
The same time.
Right. Becoming more provocative in their topics and their styles. You have Sex, Lies, and Videotape by Steven Soderbergh, Clerks by Kevin Smith, Pulp Fiction from Tarantino, Boys Don't Cry by Kimberly Pierce. These were films that were dealing with sex, queer identity, American working class, and violence in kind of unique and provocative ways. And from a mix of those ideals come George Washington, which comes a little bit after the movement. It was released in 2000, but definitely you can tell that David Gordon Green had a lot of learning experience from that era of films.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it was a very interesting time for American independent cinema. You know, this is about a decade after the real rise of Sundance as the premier film festival in America. You know, you're seeing this first Sundance generation of filmmakers really start to make their Hollywood films this time. You know, you have, this is a couple years after Quentin Tarantino made Jackie Brown and really broke out there. You know, this Sundance generation had become established filmmakers at this point.
Right. And so you had the people that grew up on the Sundance generation, or might have even been, you know, still independent Sundance generation folks, trying to take those ideals and still make movies in that lens and keep it a very small, intimate, low-budget affair and try to let the story come first.
Yeah, so this is, you know, a really great film that often gets overlooked. It was never in wide release.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get it on Criterion, on Blu-ray and DVD. It's on iTunes and Amazon and Filmstruck in the USA. There is no distribution whatsoever for this in the UK.
It's a pretty small film from release standards. It's a little hard to find.
But I think it's an important film. I think you can trace a direct route from this to Moonlight.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Barry Jenkins said that he really likes this film, and he likes its portrayal of black youth and interracial relationships in the South, in impoverished areas.
It doesn't sugarcoat it, but it also doesn't dramatize it.
It has a very, I think one of my favorite things about it is this mix of nostalgia and pain from childhood, and kind of illustrating that the warm glow of a summer and then the reality that can happen in that summer. Mm-hmm. And kind of the simultaneous trick that kids play of innocence and also sometimes knowing a little bit more than they let on.
Yeah. And this was not a critical darling.
For the few that saw it, it was decently well received. And I know a lot of people whom I respect really like it. It's much like being a film that was made by a film lover. It seems like other film lovers tend to like this film.
Yeah, and it had an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes and an 80% on Metacritic, so it did well with the critics. But it did not have, the universal acclaim like we saw from, The Florida Project or Moonlight recently.
Or even The Writer. I mean, I think a big part of it is its narrative is a little... I mean, one of my biggest complaints with it is the narrative.
It's a little weak at times.
Yeah, the narrative is not... I wouldn't even say inaccessible. Sometimes it's, not really there. Elements of the narrative were sometimes kind of come in and out of focus, and I think it's not always to the service of the movie's themes or emotions.
It feels just a little stunted on the edges, but it's a really valuable film to check out.
Yeah, a little underbaked. I mean, like I said, because the plot is so free-flowing, it can be a little difficult to summarize, but basically it's about a bunch of kids that are growing up in a small town, relatively poor, in North Carolina.
Predominantly black.
Yeah, predominantly black. Most of the work, it seems like, comes from railroad work that the adults will work on. And a lot of the kids don't have a lot of structure or opportunities in their lives. I mean, they literally play on the railroad or in empty pools or in rundown parks. It very much has that feeling of kids just wandering out.
It's a lot like Ratcatcher.
Yeah, just kids just wandering out into their environment and the realities that can accompany having an environment that's not actually suited for kids.
Yeah, and I think this film, more than even Badlands or The Rider, really faces the question of the precipice between childhood and adulthood, which is a theme that we talked about last week with Ratcatcher. I think this really drives it home that there are some kids who just sit on that edge of handling adult situations and then not.
Right. And I mean, this is, a big part of it is Kyle wants to get in his requisite 2 to 3 coming of age films every week. But
didn't you choose this one?
I did choose this one. But, I like to think it was influenced by your...
I have a type.
Yeah, it's, like I said, it balances so well that tenderness of youth with being able to handle the harsh realities and also being ill-equipped for it. I mean, the film opens up with, I love the opening scene where it's Buddy is a young, bespectacled black kid, and he's breaking up with Nazia, who is, I think, a year older than he is. They're like 11 and 12, and the way they're going about this conversation is...
She makes a big deal about either the fact that she is 13 or almost 13, as if that means she needs a real man. There's that whole exchange.
No, yeah, she's 12. A big theme for Nazia, and she is also the narrator, so we'll get into that and how it relates to Badlands. But big thing for her is that Buddy is not as mature as she wants him to be. And part of that is that Buddy's 11 years old. But Buddy is also the kind of kid that will put on a T-Rex mask and recite either Shakespeare or Bible verses in an empty, overgrown theater.
Yeah.
He very much has this combined over-seriousness and a little bit of, the goofy 11-year-old. What happens is these kids are forced to confront reality and their inability to, be mature enough for that reality. And so to that point, maturity is a big theme of the film, whether it's breaking up with your 12-year-old girlfriend or being, you know, I guess being dumped by your 12-year-old girlfriend, or dealing with having a broken family, you know, a mother who passed and a father who's in jail, so you're raised by your aunt and uncle.
And I think one of these big themes here is, you know, taking adult responsibility in adult situations. And the crucial fact is, at the key moment, the kids don't.
Mm-hmm.
They fail. They run and hide from a situation. And that just causes more pain for a lot of people around them.
So pretty similarly to The Rider and Badlands, although it's a very different environmental location, this being set in a small kind of rural North Carolina town rather than Midwest expanse. But these kids are very much trapped and defined by their environment. The reality that they play on railroads and in rundown parks and in bathrooms and stuff like that. Like that's just the area that they have, and they're sort of trapped to and defined by that limitation.
And there's also no real parental figure whatsoever. I mean, at home there is, but, you know,
right. They're
running around trying to steal cars and stuff for fun because yeah. There's no influence there. You know, they're just running wild.
Oftentimes it's a single parent household, and then those parent or parents then have a job they got to take care of, and, you know, four or five kids are just going to do what kids do, which is go off and find something more entertaining.
And they don't really have, like, a playground. They really make do with, you know, they have this just, like you said, huge areas of decay that have just been reclaimed by the earth. And they make games out of it.
And I think that tension is really beautifully illustrated, the effects of sort of a post-industrialist town where, railroads are... Even then, in 2000, but certainly now, railroads are not what they used to be. In American economics and in American occupational lifestyles. And so you have sort of the struggle of American capitalism and the inevitable sort of toll that nature takes on it.
Yeah.
The earth is literally reclaiming space, and the kids are sort of playing on this middle ground of what was once civilized, I suppose I would say, versus the reality of just kind of wild land taking it back over. So, I mean, a big part of the tension comes from the kids failing to talk to the adults about what has happened and properly deal with it. And so instead they have to kind of bear with this guilt and anxiety themselves. And it emotionally is tearing them apart. Each of them shows different displays of, like, a post-traumatic anxiety. Eventually it does. The adults do get involved and catch wind of it. But I think it's, at best at that point, it's kind of just so that the kids realize that so they can escape the guilt that they're feeling. But, I mean, a big part of it also is George, the titular character, whose last name isn't actually Washington. That's kind of...
The term George Washington is a nickname, basically, because of his obsession with heroes.
Right. And this event and this film is sort of a turning point for him in the reality of what does it mean to become a hero, and what is the pain and maturity that has to be involved in that.
And ultimately, like, he fails when he needs to.
He does.
And he goes and he redeems himself, and he is still focused on, you know, these good deeds and being a hero in his community. But when it mattered for his friends, he failed.
But I think the film doesn't actually judge him too much for that, which I...
No, because he's a kid.
Right, exactly. It's because he is on that cusp, and that's sort of the inherent and necessary pain of that maturation, is the fact that for many kids... That is, the point of maturity is when you are faced with these horrible situations and how quickly you're able to acclimate to them, and the reality that you're not going to instantly adapt to it.
And horror is a really interesting word, because I think this film dealt with real themes of horror.
Oh yeah, there's certainly...
There's a moment in this film that is breathtaking in how dark it is.
Yeah, it's a very... It has its moments of extreme... gut-wrenching sadness.
And I think a big part of that is the fact that the moment of horror is this, you know, very violent thing that is portrayed with absolute realism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happens. It's done.
nothing you can do now.
Right. I mean,
it plays out in real time without any exaggeration. And I think that's something that makes it very distinct. You know, it has an impact.
It refuses to sugarcoat how these things happen.
The finite nature of life.
Right. It illustrates in particular the reality that as heroes, we don't have superhuman powers. At best, you're a kid wearing a singlet and a helmet, and you're just trying to do the best you can with that.
It's a very interesting film. I didn't love it, honestly, but it does a lot of interesting things. And, you know, like you were talking about, the voiceovers are very clearly inspired by Malick.
Right, yeah. And I think they're used to a strong effect, like we were saying, because the voiceover in Badlands represents Holly's sort of unreliability. I think likewise, you have the voiceover ironically represents Nasia's immaturity and her blindness to some of the ugliness that is in her town. And at the same time, I think, again, doesn't necessarily condemn it because it is also...
She's a kid.
You have to appreciate the fact that she does still see beauty.
Also, it does a really interesting thing where it hides the fact that she is unaware of events going on.
Yeah, that also is... I wouldn't say she's a minor character, but as far as the ensemble goes, she's not a major focus.
I still am kind of hung up on... I don't know, they're a weird ensemble.
Much like the free-flowing nature of the narrative, characters are very naturalistically in and out.
Yeah, and that's also just like these friends feel very real because they're just kids who met each other playing. Like,
right.
They don't complement themselves each other well. You know, you have... an age difference, you have, you know, one is very clearly fairly athletic, and then you have this other kid, George, he was born with a misformed head, and he's incredibly sensitive. He can't be, you know, in water, he can't risk any kind of damage to his head.
Misformed head is such a gnarly way to put it.
The membrane on his head was misformed. Is that better?
Right. I mean, it was that his skull didn't properly fuse after infancy.
Yes, thank you.
I'm out here being a biomedical engineer, so we can really put proper terms to this.
Uh-huh. And then you have, you know, this kid, Sonia, who is one thing white, which stands out in this ensemble. She's also dramatically younger than them, and yet she rolls with the boys, and she's... totally able to keep up with them and their roughhousing and their everyday life and their hooliganism until events kind of hit the fan and she has to handle things and process things very differently.
I mean, eventually I would say that. I don't even necessarily think that... I think her role as one of the people that eventually...
I don't think she's even the most immature character.
Yeah, no, I think... I'm trying to think what I think of Sonia. I think it's interesting that her gender isn't significant. I mean, we see frequently Nasia interacts mostly with her older sister and her group of friends, or her older sister's group of friends.
And most of their conversation, you know, doesn't pass the Bechdel test. They're talking about boys, they're talking about pregnancy, they're talking about...
That kind of teenage girl thing.
And then you have Sonia, who's probably 10... You know, she's either very tiny or she's very young.
No, I would say about 10.
And, you know, I don't think they ever even really explicitly mention her gender.
Right, which I think it's interesting. I mean, very much like the natural constraints of the kids' environments, they're naturally constrained to who their friends are. You avoid a lot of interracial and intergender tension when you're young enough that... those aren't even really things that you have to consider. I might only be friends with, you know, other boys, but there's not that many. So you just kind of make friends where you get them.
And I think this film also goes out of its way not to call attention to her gender.
Right.
One of the pivotal scenes takes place in a men's room.
Right.
And because she's just there. And it's really interesting kind of how it handles that.
Yeah, I think part of... the decay of the town is maybe comes with it the decay of those societal norms that are mainly prescribed by people who like don't have anything better to do, so to speak.
Yep.
Like nobody cares that there's a girl in the men's bathroom because why would they? They got other things to worry about.
And, you know, the importance of religion is kind of pretty prominent here. Like, there's a lot of, you know, these traditional, like, Southern Baptist churches present. And that's very clearly present in their lives. And yet we do see, you know, that kind of breakdown.
Well, I think it's interesting because is it George's mother?
When the pastor comes?
Or aunt, yeah, who, there's one, I think it's George's aunt who doesn't like the pastor, because I think he illustrates to her sort of a false promise that, like, they, you know, they're aware of what their economic situation is, and they're aware that they're kind of trapped there as adults. I think it's not insignificant that one of the opening scenes is also George's uncle, Uncle Damascus, who's talking about basically the horrible toll that working on the railroad has taken on him, and the lack of benefits and lack of health care. Like, these are people very much at the end of their rope and very much forgotten. And I think sort of the inability of that religious structure to properly identify and address those needs has led to a bit of a religious languishing.
So this film's really interesting in how it kind of confronts poverty like that. And it's not a perfect film, but it's important when you're looking at, you know, where the roadmap between something like Badlands in the 70s and something today like The Rider exists.
Yeah, I mean, it honestly, the biggest disappointment to me is the fact that when the narrative kind of loses some of its direction, you're tempted to forget some of the utterly beautiful compositions and scenes. There's so many scenes that are just, like, genuinely heartwarming. And, like, for someone like me, you got to understand, like, I am not a heartwarmed person. So there are moments of, like, such genuine beauty in this movie that I wish other parts of it were a little stronger. But even as it is, I do truly appreciate its grasp on those.
This is a film where the storytelling has so many roots in naturalism, and it really, you know, tells things in a very realistic way, in a very languid and slow and taking its time way as far as the narrative. But you also have this incredible, you know, dedication to its craft and formalism where, you know, like you said, everything is beautifully composed. You know, everything's very vivid. It's very, you know, Malick-esque.
Yeah, and it has those, I mean, I don't know enough about film technique, but I don't believe it adheres to, like, the Dogma 95 principles, but...
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah, but it has a lot of those ideals in place where it's reduce a film as best you can to this watchable encapsulation of life, and let it speak for itself.
But then this adds back in these really, really gorgeously constructed images. I mean...
Oh, man.
You know, the scene of, you know, the one boy doing Shakespeare in the amphitheater, and you just have this great composition. You know, it's an interesting mix where something like Ratcatcher doesn't take the time to smell the roses that this does.
Right. Well, yeah, and again, I mean, again, with Malick, you have those, and with The Rider, you do have, yeah, you have scenes where nothing is even really happening. It's just focusing on the environment and yep. allowing the environment to be its own actor in the story. I think it's,
And not just the environment as, you know, a living, breathing character, but also just as a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, one of the differentiating things between the films we're talking about this week and the films we talked about last week, is they take that time to smell the roses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and that's very much, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to say it's a product of Malick, but Malick definitely had a huge influence on popularizing that idea.
Yes. So we hope you enjoyed that. These are all really great films that you should check out.
I think they're all probably some of the most accessible versions of this kind of idea that we're talking about, of this expanse.
Badlands is definitely Malick's most accessible film.
Yeah.
And I'm someone who's pretty critical of his work in general, and I really appreciate Badlands.
I mean, David Gordon Green has certainly gone on to make more accessible films, but, not with this kind of theme.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to see kind of the direction his career went.
Yeah, it's, I guess it is kind of what you were saying. Eventually, like, these people go on to, a lot of these people go on to make studio films, which is where he But at the same time, Pineapple Express is a little bit of a satirization of studio filmmaking.
And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying they're fundamentally different.
Yeah, moving away from that highly naturalistic approach.
Yes.
I mean, Malick's first film being really the most studio-directed one of his is an inversion of that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting comparing that to one of his more recent films, where a lot of that structure is gone.
Yeah, like the film, the documentary literally talking about the beginning of the universe.
Yeah. So, next week, what are we talking about?
Well, if all goes according to plan, we're talking about First Reformed by Paul Schrader, Winterlight by Ingmar Bergman, and The Passion of Joan of Arc by Carl Theodor Dreyer. But we are not entirely certain if First Reformed is indeed coming out as soon as that. So, you know...
It technically is supposed to come out on the 31st.
Yeah, we're all waiting with bated breath to see if the VOD release does not screw over the indie studio as much as it tends to.
You know, so we'll really be dealing with the themes of kind of faith and doubt portrayed on film from a, you know, mostly Christian perspective throughout film history, particularly doubt and how it affects, you know, humanity.
You're right. A very human approach to faith, I think, and the reality of what having faith means for people on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something Bergman really handles really well, kind of, you know, the human reckoning with our own humanity and belief and trust.
Right.
So look forward to that. You can always email us with, you know, comments, critique, and suggestions at framesofreference@bravevoicefilms.com.
So some other podcasts that we're listening to on film that we really like include Criterion Cast, Linoleum Knife, Fix a Flick, Film Spotting, and Fighting in the War Room. So if you want to get more into film podcasting, check those folks out.
This podcast is produced by Brave Voice Films. I'm Kyle.
I'm Matthew.
Have a good week. We'll see you in 2 weeks.